some alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military-industrial complex.
A highly funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Turmoil in Pakistan. That's the topic of PID Radio tonight. Welcome. I'm Derek Gilbert. Sharon is taking the evening off, but don't worry. We've got plenty of voices here, and we're not going to lack for content over the next 60 minutes. We're going to talk about the assassination of former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, and we'll get into that in just a second. Couple of quick program notes. We will be back again next Sunday, of course, as we return to our weekly schedule. We appreciate you letting us have the week off over Christmas. Some interesting things have taken place over the last couple of weeks, and we'll get into that. But as we go into 2008, we are working on ramping up the PID radio site and the peeringintodarkness.com sites. Do check out peeringintodarkness.com on a daily basis. Sharon is editing that and really pulling together a collection of news stories that are far underreported by the major media. PIDradio.com, we had the radio archives, the show archives online up until we made the transition this summer and, you know, pulled everything offline. Now we're uploading it again, but we're uploading the archives this time in a higher quality, in CD quality, FM radio quality anyway. So the old interviews that we had online will be back shortly, and we're getting those up even as we speak. You'll see a new link to the PID Radio archives in the right-hand column at PIDradio.com. So now our guests, two young men who we lovingly refer to as the Frog Brothers because we consider them experts in matters of the arcane, and we say that with great respect because we do think that these two fellows are some of the most intelligent and insightful researchers in the world of crypto politics today. They're regular contributors at the Conspiracy Archive and also a frequent guest on the excellent radio program For a Closer Look, hosted by Michael Corbin. We're proud to welcome back to PID Radio Paul and Philip Collins. Guys, good to have you back.
Thanks, Derek.
Thank you so much, Derek.
Well, Benazir Bhutto, you guys have been doing some research into her connection to the strange world of Pakistani politics and how that might have gotten her killed. I mean, on its face, the assassination of Benazir Bhutto looks pretty clear. It looks like a political hit by her enemies inside Pakistan. Is it that simple?
Well, in the wake of that whole assassination, many people have been asking the questions: who killed Benazir Bhutto and what was the motive? And when you look into that, things are not as clear-cut as it might seem. In an article entitled "Main Suspects Are Warlords and Security Forces," the Time Online South Asia correspondent Jeremy Page pointed out several people, that several different groups and factions that wanted her killed, namely an Al-Qaeda leader by the name of Baitullah Massoud, located there, who was behind the Karachi bomb blast in October, mm-hmm. that was meant to take Bhutto's life, ended up killing 140 people. But Page also pointed out that the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence Agency, the ISI, was a likely suspect too. That he pointed out that the accusatory finger would be pointed at ISI. And he stated rather cryptically that the ISI, quote, stood to lose money and power, unquote, if Bhutto came to power. And he really failed to elaborate with what he meant by that. And people might think, well, why would the ISI want Bhutto dead? And the answer may lie in Bhutto's past election, her post-election plans, what she had planned if she should win the election. And early in 2007, she declared what she had planned. She said that she was going to support giving the International Atomic Energy Agency access to Abdul Qadir Khan, who was the head of the notorious nuclear black market network. And he's also the individual that was responsible for giving the world what is known as the Islamic bomb. If the International Atomic Energy Agency had gained access to Khan, it may have been discovered that the Khan network was largely the creation of the Pakistani ISI, the Saudi royals, and the Western power elite. So the answer to the question would be 100 times more complex than most people would be willing to look into, because many people would just want a clear cut. It was this terrorist group. It was Al Qaeda. It was the Taliban.
Well, we'll talk about that in a couple of minutes, because I have already noticed it was hard not to notice that within a matter of minutes of the assassination, the name Al Qaeda was on everyone's lips, at least everyone in the neocon main media, major media. But for a little background, for people who aren't familiar with AQ Khan and what he did, why is the AQ Khan network important? Why would somebody want to cover up his connections to the Saudis and to the West?
Well, the Khan network was the product of imagination of the power elite that was known as the Safari Club. And the Safari Club was basically a marriage between the American elite and the Saudi elite. It was a partnership that led to the CIA switching its reliance for regional intelligence from Israel to Saudi Arabia. That switch came at a time when the pro-Israel faction within the CIA suffered a major loss. In 1974, you had Bill Colby, who was DCI at that time, firing the pro-Israel counterintelligence chief, James Angleton. And Angleton was no angel, to say the least. I remember when I did an interview with Jimmy Rothstein, the NYPD police detective, legendary police detective. He said that if there was ever an evil man that just topped the list as far as the most evil people on the face of the planet, it would be Angleton. But Angleton, nonetheless, was very much a pro-Israel influence in the CIA, and made sure that their interest was met as far as our intelligence dealings in that region of the world.
So what you're saying is that despite the outward appearance, the outward support given by the United States government to the nation of Israel, the fact is that the intelligence services of the U.S. Switched sides back in the 70s, and that we have secretly been supporting the Arabs against Israel for over 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, with Angleton gone, an obstacle was out of the way. The CIA could now look to the Saudi royal family for the assistance that they needed. The agency began making overtures towards the Saudi royals around 1976, which was a very dark time in intelligence history. 1973 saw the end of America's ground involvement in Vietnam. 2 short years later, Saigon fell. 1974, we saw the Watergate affair happen. By 1976, the American people were fed up, and investigators initiated what has become known as the infamous Year of Intelligence. And the Church and Pike committees were just dissecting the intelligence community. While many intelligence crimes remained hidden, enough was exposed to give the American people a smell. Mm-hmm. They got a sense of just how bad it had gotten. So Congress was not willing to give a nickel to any covert ops anywhere in the world, to any kind of intelligence operations. And so the CIA had to prevent their money well from running dry, and they couldn't go necessarily to Israel for that kind of financial backing. It was the Saudis that were basically filthy rich, the royals, and so it would be natural to turn to the Saudi royals if you were looking for financiers. I mean, Israel has no oil really to speak of, and all, nothing of any significance at least. And it's Saudi Arabia that really is made a fortune off of the black gold. And so the Safari Club became a vehicle. It was through this vehicle that the Saudi royals took over the intelligence financing for America. And all of this was done in the name of fighting communism. And meanwhile, behind the scenes, the American power elite were actually propping up communism and keeping the Cold War dialectic going because it was expedient for
profitable.
Them. Yeah, it was very profitable. And also when you're looking for excuses to do certain things, it helps to have a boogeyman.
Mm-hmm.
And they could basically exploit native fears of communism here to present their own kind of authoritarian system as a bulwark to the Soviet Imperium, and that's exactly what they did. The club was made up of France, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Morocco, and Iran, but it was the Saudi Arabians and its corrupt power elite that were basically leading the charge with the Safari Club. And the Safari Club began around 78 to lure the Soviet Union into a quagmire in Afghanistan. And the Islamic fighters there began raiding Soviet territory and taunting the Soviets to invade. And what many people don't know is that those Islamic fighters were under the sponsorship of the Safari Club.
Mm-hmm.
And this invasion would allow the West to give the Soviet Union its equivalent of Vietnam. See, the power elite are made up of Hegelian activists. And when you're working off of a Hegelian script, the nation states have to go tit for tat with their victories and their defeats.
Mm-hmm.
And America had already taken its fall with Vietnam. Now it was the Soviet Union's turn to take a dive. And so
from that, can we conclude that Iraq is it's back? The pendulum swung back, and Iraq is our turn again.
Something, yeah, probably to a large extent, yeah. That's
just an observation, anyway. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the invasion would also provide the pretext to radicalize Islamic people. The power elite would take advantage of the blowback that would come out of the radicalization campaign, because what they did is they went over there and through textbooks that were put together here in the United States on money from the Agency for International Development,
mm-hmm.
They indoctrinated people into, I don't want to necessarily say it was a radical form of Islam. It was more like Islam transformed into a neo-Gnostic jihadist kind of cult. Really?
Well, that's been in the works since after World War II, though, when the Nazis were basically escorted out of former Nazis were former former mafia or former CIA. It's a misnomer. Anyway, when Nazis were smuggled out of Germany after World
mm-hmm.
War II and put into Saudi Arabia and Egypt to help nurture the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah, what happened?
They've been radicalizing the Muslims since at least the 1930s, 1940s. I mean, it's no secret as to why, it's no mystery as to why Hezbollah, Fatah, Hamas use the Nazi salute today. They've been radicalizing it, turning it into a cult for years, even by the 70s.
Yeah, yeah. Intelligence sources that we've known, guys that have actually been over there, say that when they want to figure out the guerrilla tactics of the different terrorist organizations in that region of the world, all they have to do is look back to the Nazi playbook,
mm-hmm.
because it mirrors their playbook to a T. And it's like, for the reasons that you said, Otto Skorzeny was brought mm-hmm. over to Egypt, and he brought over scores of Nazis because the CIA wanted to basically get rid of King Farouk in Egypt, and this would of course lead to eventually the rise of Nasser over there. But they began training the Egyptian military and indoctrinating the Egyptian military into Nazi doctrine, like you were saying. But But really what it is it's not even hardly Islam anymore. We have a similar project here in the United States with the Dominionist, where Christianity is turned on its head and transformed into a neo-Gnostic jihadist cult as well.
Right.
It's the same principle at work, where Islam is basically transformed into this neo-Gnostic.
The tip of Allah's sword and the Dominionist have been turned into the tip of Yahweh's sword or Jehovah's sword.
Yeah,
or Jesus' sword.
Basically,
yeah.
what they have done is that the adherents of either Dominionism or this extremely theologically distorted aberration of Islam, what they do is basically they've reconceptualized objects of faith, particularly the eschaton, that is the end of days. They've reconceptualized these transcendent objects of faith as objects of immanent experience, and this leads to what Eric Voegelin called in the New Science of Politics, what he called immanentizing the eschaton.
Basically. Oh, yes, I was hoping you'd say that phrase.
Yeah. Well, I know I bring that up quite a bit, but...
It's excellent point.
It's central because basically, this immanentism and this immanentist doctrine underpins all socio-political utopianism.
Yeah. Because what you're doing is you're taking an object of faith and you're coming up with a secular version of it.
Yeah.
And so the sixth pillar of faith in Islam is no longer a spiritual warfare. It becomes very much a real political and military war.
Yes, and you see that very much illustrated with the Dominionist in particular. Ted Haggard, who has been tied to Dominionism, he basically presented a new reconceptualized version of the verse in Ephesians where it's talking about how the weapons of our warfare are not carnal.
Mm-hmm.
He says that basically spiritual warfare has its own this-worldly counterpart in preemptive war. And preemptive warfare, which of course is very, very expedient to neoconservative interests,
sure.
Given the fact that neoconservatives are consistently
a mainstay of their doctrine.
Yeah, and ironically enough, preemptive warfare and preventative warfare came into vogue, came into vogue astride the age of social Darwinism and eugenics.
Mm-hmm.
So that concept's not even Christian. That concept's
Christian. It's not Muslim. It really comes out of a different trajectory. But it has totally taken those two Abrahamic faiths hostage.
Yeah, and pitted them directly opposed to one another. And by the way, I again say this with great respect, but you two fellows are the only guys we know who can say immanentizing the eschaton in the course of a normal conversation without doing it to try to sound smarter than you are. I mean, without doing it just to try to impress people. So, tip of the headphones, because we know when you say those words, it's because you really know what you're talking about and you mean what you say.
Well, Visigoth made that like off limits for the remainder of all of our interviews and everything.
No, we were listening last night. In fact, you did the interview with Michael Corbin on For a Closer Look, and we were really disappointed that you didn't say immanentizing the eschaton. We were really hoping for it. So, getting back to Benazir Bhutto and the product of this long, I know that we need to go through a lot of territory to cover some background here, but what we've got is a radical movement then in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
That is being sponsored under the Carter administration by the CIA and the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Services, who set up the madrasas there to train and school and indoctrinate a generation of mujahideen, the Taliban.
That's correct. And ISI is essentially nothing more than a CIA surrogate. As a matter of fact, the head of Pakistan's ISI has to be approved by the American DCI, the Director of Central Intelligence.
Are you kidding me?
No, that's an absolute fact. But the funny thing is that Zbigniew Brzezinski admitted that CIA aid was going to the Mujahideen beginning July 3rd of 1979, prior to the Soviet invasion. And the funny thing is that all of the history books has said for the longest time that our aid, that the CIA did not begin aiding the Mujahideen until after the Soviet invasion.
Right.
So the CIA aid helped lure the Soviet Union into this trap in Afghanistan. And what Brzezinski did is he proposed the idea to Carter in a 1979 memo. And in that memo, he warned Carter. He said, now look, you know, we do this, efforts to prevent nuclear proliferation in Pakistan are going to be hampered, you know. But, he said, but, you know, the plan is well worth the stretch.
Right.
Because it'll give the Soviets their Vietnam. So what Brzezinski was really doing, you know, is he was giving himself an out if the plan was a disaster. He, you know, well, I warned the president. But he was also giving, kind of providing at the same time, the rationale for America to look the other way as Pakistan gained the nuclear bomb, because he said, you know, it would be worth the risk.
Now, and we've made it very clear when there are certain countries out there. I mean, ironically, now we're on the brink of war with Iran because we don't want Iran to get a nuclear weapon, an Islamic nuclear bomb. But essentially, if I understand you fellas correctly, what happened in Pakistan is we kind of winked and nodded and looked the other way when the Pakistanis developed a nuke because we wanted their help to support the Taliban against the Russians.
That's one of the reasons that we allowed them to get the nuke. But there's also some very long range plans as well there, and like which will become obvious to the audience as we go along.
Okay.
Many people had warned that Brzezinski would have an unhealthy influence on Carter. One individual that warned about his influence on Carter was Carter's campaign advisor, Hamilton Jordan. Jordan stated at one point, he said, like flat out, he said, quote, if after the inauguration of Jimmy Carter you find Zbigniew Brzezinski as head of national security, then I would say we failed and I quit, unquote. And he didn't quit. But he certainly knew that Brzezinski would be an unhealthy influence, and he would not have said that if he didn't know that Brzezinski was an agent of the power elite, which Carter had railed against in his writings and now was actually jumping into bed with.
Same thing happened under Ronald Reagan, where he found that all of his advisors were members of the CFR, basically. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, Brzezinski would end up forming the Trilateral Commission, which is actually the sister group to the Council on Foreign Relations. And this group was formed, the organizational meetings began in 72. The group formally came together in 73, basically to give elitists another conduit to work through, because the CFR had been severely hurt by the Vietnam War. People saw that the policymakers who came up with that disastrous war had come out of the CFR, so they needed another organization to work through. And when Brzezinski put the Trilateral Commission together, he looked to David Rockefeller for help to do so. And David Rockefeller, of course, is America's consummate elitist. And he was, at the time of the Trilateral Commission's organization, Rockefeller was at the time the chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. All eight American representatives who were at the founding meeting of the Trilateral Commission were CFR. And it's also important to point out Brzezinski's involvement in the intelligence community. He was recruited by Ted Shackley, the head of the Directorate of Operations, basically the covert operations wing of the CIA. He was recruited by the Blonde Ghost when he was a young Polish student. And Shackley had been a close friend and associate of Edwin Wilson. Edwin Wilson is the individual that basically put together for Shackley and Tom Clines and the covert operators America's private intelligence network, a network for the covert wing of the CIA to work through with, while avoiding oversight, congressional oversight in accountability. Edwin Wilson's one associate, Congressman Charlie Wilson, was working in Congress to block any and all attempts to stop American funding of Pakistan. Charlie Wilson, of course, right now is...
Charlie Wilson's War, the movie, mm-hmm. with Tom Hanks. Okay.
And that movie just totally disgusts me because it's glorifying a man. It's trying to say, well, here's a man that was a hedonist that got religion or something. They, you know, found a cause to fight for. And it's that's not the way that this man was. Wilson knew that that Pakistan was going to obtain the bomb through these efforts, through American funding of Pakistan. He even told President Zia of Pakistan at one point, he said, quote, "Mr. President, as far as I'm concerned, you can make all the bombs you want," unquote. He was also responsible for when Congressman Murphy could no longer be worked through to get aid to the Nicaraguan dictator Somoza. Wilson became kind of the front man for Murphy and was able to get aid to Anastasio Somoza, who I know that the Sandinistas weren't much better, but he wasn't any kind of gentle giant, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, he was not the good person that they're trying to make him out to be, or, you know, in this movie.
So basically, all we've got, what we've got here going behind the scenes are heavy hitters, power brokers, Brzezinski, you know, Rockefeller, Wilson, you know, whatever, these forces operating in the shadows of the American government, power elites, conspiring basically to set up Pakistan under President or General Muhammad Zia-ul-Haq to develop its own nuclear weapon, while at the same time we were trying to keep other nations from getting nukes. Now, where does AQ Khan come into the story?
Well, much of the money going to Pakistan was making its way through AQ Khan. And what happened was that the Safari Club made a deal with Pakistan, which basically said that Pakistani intelligence would handle all the money that was going to the Afghan war, that ISI would handle all of the money, and that included hundreds of millions of dollars from the United States and Saudi Arabia, and they would have no accountability on Pakistan's part. They could take the money and divvy it out as they saw fit. And as a result, a lot of that money ended up going into an Islamic nuclear weapons program that was supported by Saudi Arabia, and the United States knew it was going on and just winked and looked the other way. And this was, of course, Pakistan's nuclear program. And we know that by the 90s, British Customs had become interested with AQ Khan's network, and they penetrated AQ Khan's network through an Arabic-speaking Muslim agent. And what they found out through that agent was that the United States knew that this syndicate was out there, and that this syndicate was busy making a bomb. But the United States didn't have any interest in stopping the network. The French intelligence group, their intelligence also found out that this was going on, and came to similar conclusions when they looked into AQ Khan's network. What they found is that the United States was allowing Pakistan to essentially become Saudi Arabia's proxy. And it would be a proxy that was the first Islamic nuclear state. And the United States was not going to do anything to stop this. They just kept looking the other way, and in some instances they actually helped to the nuclear weapons program. Some of the parts came from America, as a matter of fact. Khan had a daughter attending school in England, and Khan would send faxes to his daughter, and it was faxes that were supposed to be dealing specifically with her education. But at the end of some of these faxes, written in Khan's handwriting, were all these different ingredients that he needed for the nuclear program.
You got to be kidding me.
No. Uh-uh.
Oh, by the way, sweetheart, can you please send us some plutonium?
Exactly. That kind of nonsense was going on. And so as a result of this, a lot of the parts for nuclear weapons were coming directly from the United States. The United States knew it was going on, and they did not. The power elite here in the United States and the political leadership knew it was going on, and they did nothing to stop it.
Yeah. Oh, honey, while you're out, will you pick up some plutonium, please? Because we're running low. So.
And all of this basically allowed Khan, his network, to go global. I mean, the syndicate ended up everywhere: Libya, Malaysia, Iran, North Korea, any place that needed weapons equipment. Khan's syndicate was there to supply it, to provide it. And you know, so I mean, like you can listen to Joe Lieberman and Bush and Dick Cheney. And basically all the different talking heads on Fox News rant and rave over Iran and their nuclear program, but you have to remember that the United States is in part responsible for that threat because we looked the other way while Khan was supplying weapons equipment to Iran.
Yes, and so much so. I mean, evidently the problem had gotten so out of hand with Khan's network that at a press conference that was hosted by the Middle East Institute in September, it was none other than Bhutto herself who said, and I quote, "We do believe that the IAEA would have the right to put questions to AQ Khan that would satisfy them and give the world community greater confidence that the illegal structure has been broken and that no more dangerous repercussions for the world community come about due to those activities," unquote. So essentially what Bhutto was basically pledging to do, now whether or not she would have done it is another question, but the fact is that her voicing the very intent would put her in the crosshairs of some very nasty people. Basically what she would have done was she would have made it possible for Khan's network not only to have been scrutinized and possibly dismantled, but also another unintended corollary of any investigation that was worth a darn would have turned up the involvement of the Safari Club and, by extension, the Western elite.
Well, therein lies the rub. I think that it's very unlikely that any investigation would turn up anything just because the IAEA as a – and you know, and see if maybe I'm being oversimplistic here, but as a branch of the United Nations, which is itself a tool of the global power elite, I don't know that they would have any incentive to turn up anything or find anything because the people they work for would be the ones who would be shown with their hands in the cookie jar.
Well, now by saying so, that's committing the cardinal sin within this research field, the sin of believing in a monolithic conspiracy where everybody is controlled top down.
Well, that's why I asked if I was being too simplistic here. Okay.
Yeah. There's systemic corruption in the United Nations to be for sure. And all you have to do is look at the founders to see what the intentions were. But that doesn't mean that there are not good people working there, and there isn't good people staffed at the United Nations that would actually do their job. I mean, like, I've heard a lot of people try to say that because of her work at the United Nations, Angelina Jolie is the queen of darkness or something, which is like, are you kidding me? It's ridiculous. You know, she's doing what she's doing probably for PR purposes, you know, if you want to get really cynical, and she might actually have a genuine love for it. She might actually believe in the cause.
Yeah.
Also bear in mind that with the United Nations has been has not been very well regarded by other factions of the power elite here as of late. The United Nations is being regarded as impotent, And to a certain extent, the United Nations is waning in its dominance. Boutros-Ghali made it clear in an article a few years back that the United Nations was probably on its way out towards the Dutch spin of history. And what would happen is that what remaining infrastructure was in place would be renovated, and a new beast would arise. Now, that's not to say that you know, anything new coming out of the United Nations would be any better than the old United Nations. The point is that the United Nations doesn't have quite as much political and social capital in the game to establish world government
and
as it used to.
That very impotence may force its hand to actually produce a few results.
On top of that, one of the factions of the power elite that is currently highly critical of the United Nations is none other than the neoconservatives.
Mm-hmm.
And the neoconservatives are more so advocates of initiating a world government unilaterally, with America acting as the spearhead of that world government, whereas the United Nations was more so favorable of a multilateral approach to establishing world government. Now, the neoconservatives are one of the parties that stand to profit the most from Boutros' assassination, because, as you know, the neoconservatives have been rattling their spears against Iran.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, neoliberals have been doing the same, and this might represent a point of convergence amongst those two factions.
Yeah, I'm convinced that they're pretty much one and the same. You ever notice how often, for example, Al Sharpton gets to talk on, like, you know, Sean Hannity's show?
Sure.
Yeah, anyway.
Well, yeah, the neoliberals for the longest time, they were more so Fabian gradualist. They had a much more piecemeal approach to establishing world government.
Yeah, they would rather do their conquest using the IMF and the World Bank and kind of the Richard Gardner script of piecemeal world government through treaties and through agreements, and then you just have the military as kind of a third tier repo man, a third option repo man that basically comes into play when the World Bank and the IMF can't collect.
Whereas the neoconservatives are much more militaristic, much more reminiscent of the Roman militaristic empire type model.
Especially late Roman Empire, when we hire lots and lots of foreign mercenaries to do the dirty work.
Absolutely. But at any rate, so as you know, the neoconservatives, and none other than Ron Paul has pointed this out, and of course so has Seymour Hersh, had plans for preemptive strikes against Iran in the works for quite some time.
Yeah.
And with the release of the National Intelligence Estimate, the argument for preemptive strikes against Iran was considerably weakened by the fact that the National Intelligence Estimate basically depicted Iran as somewhat impotent, and it said that Iran's nuclear program was not progressing anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But according to Iran specialist Ilan Berman, who's the vice president for policy at the American Foreign Policy Council in Washington, according to him, Iran might capitalize on Bhutto's assassination, because with Bhutto out of the way and no possibility of the IAEA being brought to bear on AQ Khan, the acquisition of WMD related knowledge from Pakistan would probably increase. And there you have right there the long term dividends for the neoconservatives becoming much more evident, because a nuclear-empowered Iran would certainly prove most expedient to their plans and to their objectives and to their agenda.
It would revitalize interest in invading.
War on Terror, prosecuting it into Iran, which was a declared goal of the Project for the New American Century back 10 years ago during the Clinton administration.
Yeah, and that's why a United Nations led investigation would probably turn up something, because the United Nations is opposed to any such plans. The United Nations...
It represents a different faction of the elite right
now.
Yeah,
okay.
You
go ahead, because I've got a couple of questions here about Bhutto and what she actually thought she could accomplish. But you go ahead and get your next point in,
okay.
and then we'll kick that around. I've got some real questions that have been really troubling me ever since I first heard about her return to Pakistan. In fact, in my opinion, her death was a matter of time. But
One possible hypothesis that we've put forward before, and I brought this up last night on Michael's show, and I'll bring it up here again. One possibility is that, and this plays right back into what we're talking about, Saudi Arabia using its proxy, Pakistan, an Islamic nuclear state, to provide the pretext to get this war back up and running for the neocons. And Iran views itself as the Persian Empire.
Mm-hmm.
Mitajad is one of many amongst the political leadership over there that wants to see a revived Persian Empire coming out of Iran. What does that mean they have to do? Well, they have to swallow up all the Gulf states. They have to swallow up Kuwait. They have to swallow up Bahrain. They got to swallow up Libya. And they have to swallow up Saudi Arabia. Well, Saudi Arabia, of course, does not want that to happen. So what they could do is, through their nuclear proxy, Pakistan, is have some kind of nuclear weapon go off here in the United States or some American asset somewhere else, and then that gets blamed on Iran, and the neocons have their war back up and running.
Mm-hmm.
And an event like that would certainly lead to what is needed to get the American Empire back up and rolling, because what is needed is a troop surge. I mean, like, they need their numbers to swell like never before, and the only way you're going to get that is through a draft. You got to get give Charlie Rangel, Bill Clinton's old buddy, a reason to get back out there and to start saying we need a draft, and that's what would basically get the ball rolling again.
From the Saudi standpoint, just having a nuclear ally on the far side of Iran as a bulwark, or as a counterweight, as a threat on Iran's far border, is certainly not a bad idea, at least from the Saudi perspective. But again, from the American perspective, as we Americans have been led to believe through our media for years and years and years, we are staunch allies of Israel, and yet for the last 30-plus years, and I think John Loftus, and I've not read this book, and I do need to do it, I believe argues in his book, The Secret War Against the Jews, it may even have been longer than 30 years, but we have been secretly arming the enemies of Israel.
That's true.
And certainly, you know, and not to get too far afield, that can certainly explain why Israel has shown no restraint when it comes to sending spies into the United States to spy on what we're doing here. Looking at Benazir Bhutto and her role in all of this and what this might reveal, she was basically run out of office twice and accused with corruption. Her reputation, at least as far as I can see so far in the media reports, is being rehabilitated in death. And she is being elevated to the status of a liberator, one who was a champion of freedom and democracy and civil rights and yada, 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 which is quite a bit different than the way she was perceived at the time.
Her husband was known as Mr. 10%.
she was worth over $1 billion, much of which was obtained illegally, at least illegal by American standards. I guess in France it's okay for the French to, you know, pay bribes to foreign officials, but or at least it used to be. But by American standards, she ran a very corrupt regime. Her government was one of only three in the world that recognized the Taliban as an authentic, legitimate government, and it supplied the Taliban with arms and resources. And given our history with Pakistan, it's probable, or at least conceivable, that she was doing so with American support. I say all of this just to, as a reminder that when we see all the news coverage of Benazir Bhutto in the days and weeks ahead, that we just remember that she wasn't a saint. She was a pragmatist. I think Mark Stein referred to her as a grubby ward healer. And this is coming from a guy who used to live next door to her, was her next door neighbor. And Mark Stein, being a neocon, basically blames the U.S. Department of State for sending her to her death by arranging what he called a shotgun marriage with General Musharraf. I don't believe that people rise to the highest levels of government by being idiots. And the guys in the State Department who arranged this power-sharing deal between Pervez Musharraf and Benazir Bhutto must have known that going back to Pakistan was suicide for her.
Mm-hmm.
As part of the deal, they got Musharraf to agree to release tens of millions of dollars of assets, worth of assets, that had been frozen in Swiss bank accounts since the 90s, since she was run out of the country the last time. That's a pretty strong incentive for Bhutto to return to Pakistan. And she must have known how dangerous it was for her, because not only did Musharraf not want her there, let's be honest, the radical Islamists who were the product of the madrasas there weren't going to serve under a woman who was a moderate Muslim. I mean, let's face it, serious hardcore Muslims don't have any use for moderate Muslims, consider them to be even, well, at least as bad infidels as Christians and Jews. So, I mean, she had to know she was walking into what could be a death trap. The people who sent her there, who set up this deal, had to know.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes down again to the final question. Well, a couple of questions. Why'd she go? Did she go? And what was this just strictly a lure in order to set up the scenario that you guys have been laying out, a convenient excuse to go to war with Iran?
It's kind of the same thing that you see when you look at organized crime, where somebody knows that they're not sitting too pretty with the organization, and one day two or three guys show up at your door and say, "Hey, get on your clothes, come on, we got to go. You know, the boss wants us to do this." And the two individuals, the two strong men that shown up, know the real nature of the plan, and the real nature of the plan is probably to off you. I mean, you see that all. It's the same principle at work here. No matter how corrupt or not corrupt Bhutto was, really is irrelevant because if you break the unwritten laws that govern that world, you make yourself a target, whether you are a saint or a sinner. And I can bring up lots of different examples, such as James Forrestal. I'm convinced that man was thrown to his death at Bethesda. I don't think that he committed suicide at all. He was responsible for Caltex, which was the parent company of Aramco. He was in bed with the Nazis. He was in bed with the Dulles brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he did things that ticked off the establishment enough to kill him. We know that both Kennedy brothers were probably in all likelihood killed by conspiracies, but they had a lot of dirt on their hands. Their father had worked with organized crime. Their father was mobbed up, and on and on. You can just prattle off the list. You know, Joe McCarthy. He served a purpose, but for a time to the establishment, because he was attracting people away from the establishment. He was making them look away from the establishment and making them look at domestic communist subversion. But eventually he made the establishment angry when he started to go after William Bundy, wondering why the man had given so much money to Alger Hiss's defense fund and everything. And all of a sudden hellfire came down on him. So, I mean, like, when you play in this game, with players in this game, it doesn't matter, how corrupt they are or how tight they are with other people involved in the global oligarchical establishment. If you break the unwritten nonverbal laws that govern that world, you make yourself a target. And I think that principle holds true with Benazir Bhutto.
Yeah, like the Kennedys, Bhutto was just making all the wrong people angry. And basically, there are probably several motives underpinning her assassination. And Paul and I, neither of us are by any means asserting that the maintenance of AQ Khan's network is the sole motive. But we are asserting that it is perhaps the one motive with the longest-term dividends and the most compelling of motives for her assassination. Because, after all, the maintenance of AQ Khan's nuclear network not only would possibly help provide the pretext for preemptive strikes against Iran, but from a longer, in terms of long-term dividends, the crusade for world government has always been predicated upon fear and upon exploiting particular fear, external threats to humanity, what could be called the beyond. That term is coined by a literary critic. I forget his name, but basically it refers to a situation that leaves humanity hopelessly dwarfed both ontologically and epistemologically. Our minds are incapable of grasping it. It's far outside our experiential knowledge. And in this instance, the beyond happens to be nuclear weapons and the power of the atom itself. And several people have presented atomic power as a possible catalyst for establishing world government. I believe it was Bertrand Russell who once proposed that all nuclear weapons be handed over to the United Nations so that the United Nations could effectively govern a world government with, of course, the leverage of nuclear annihilation for any nation that decided not to accept, you know, their peaceful world government. This is pretty much the way it works all the way back to the inception of the nuclear bomb, all the way back to the Manhattan Project. The Manhattan Project was in essence inspired by H.G. Wells. And H.G. Wells was a very outspoken proponent of world government. H.G. Wells had many dubious organizational affiliations. Among one of them was the Coefficients Club, and that was formed by Beatrice Webb, who was a Fabian socialist. And the Coefficients Club assembled some of Britain's most prominent thinkers and social critics to basically discuss the course of the British Empire. And that organization was a globalist one, and it promoted a unilateral form of world government, kind of along the same unilateral scheme that the neoconservatives are proffering today.
Yeah, basically,
a unilateral form of world government dominated by Britain, what was called at the time Pax Britannia. And one of the club's members was none other than Bertrand Russell. And according to Bertrand Russell, Wells and several other members held this overwhelming preoccupation with war. Another club member,
it seems like a lot more fun when you're not actually the one in the foxhole being shot at.
Oh, of course, of course.
We just have We just have a few minutes left, Paul, Philip. To kind of bring things home here, I think you lay out some pretty compelling possible motives for the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. It's certainly easy enough to blame her death on the actions of Al-Qaeda or radical Islam, which serves or seems to serve the purpose of the neocons in stirring up public opinion against the against Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, radical Islam in general. But is the political unrest, instability in Pakistan, is that something that the neocons would have figured on? And I shouldn't say the neocons, though I'm accusing them, but let's say whoever pulled the levers behind this assassination, is the unrest in Pakistan, the instability in Pakistan, something they wanted?
They never want Pakistan to be a stable country. It's never been intended that Pakistan would be a stable country. If you go back to the Cold War days, Pakistan and India were played off of one another.
Mm-hmm.
China was Pakistan's card. Pakistan was China's card.
India was Russia's card. They were basically fighting a proxy war with one another through those two. They considered one another to be competitors due to the Sino-Soviet split. And America ended up teaming up with the Chinese side there around the time of Nixon, and because they were hoping that if the Soviet Imperium ever became too difficult to manage, that China would cast its lot in with America in a war against the Soviet Union, and so America and China were using Pakistan, and India was being used by Russia, and that situation has never really changed all that much. It's simply mutated and metastasized. The countries Pakistan has never had what you would call any self-determination and any real independence to speak of. Back during the 80s, it was used as a covert launching pad for operations into the Balkans and into Afghanistan, and it's a puppet. It's supposed to stay a puppet.
And so it goes, and we see more of the same in the death of Benazir Bhutto, and will remain to be seen what actually comes out of the unrest and the disturbance that's currently brewing in the country there. Paul Collins and Philip Collins have been our guests on PID Radio for this hour. Paul, the author of The Hidden Face of Terrorism. Philip, the editor of The Hidden Face of Terrorism, the two of them co-authors of the excellent book, The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship. And you can find a link to their work at the show notes, in the show notes, at PIDradio.com. Paul, Philip, this hour went very quickly, much too quickly, because we've only scratched the surface of the crypto-political world of the sub-Asian continent, or the Asian subcontinent, rather, and the long arms of the Western elites playing in someone else's backyard once again. And we'll have to do this again very, very soon.
Sure thing.
All right, Paul, Philip, thank you much. Thank you for listening for this hour. Again, the show notes with links to their writing and everything that we've discussed tonight at PIDradio.com. Sharon will be back next week as we will have a lot to blather about. Until then, thanks for listening. There's a new day coming, a new day coming now. There's a new day coming. Oh, there's a new day coming, a new day coming now. There's a new day coming. We'll be right back.
analysis on demand.
This is PID Radio.